It seems like Indian consumers have unsatiable demand for content. Like, whatever you throw at them, they'll keep on consuming untiringly.
I mean, today, though a lot of content is being generated, to discover a content is still a challenge. So now, if someone makes a content, the first challenge is where to put it. I think leadership is all about backing your team, believing in your team, getting the right guys to do the right stuff, standing by them. Need to have a vision. If you don't have a hunger, you will not strive for more.
Hello, hello. Welcome to the Strategy of Finance podcast, where we celebrate the profession and the professionals in the world of finance. We endeavor to unpack their journeys to understand what moves them, get inspired by their triumphs, learn from their experiences, and most of all, connect with them at a personal level. Let's end the wait and listen on to learn, grow, and inspire.
Hi, Sanjay. Welcome to Strategy of Finance podcast.
Hi, Rohit. Thank you so much for inviting me on this series of finance and finance-related stuff.
Our pleasure. Why don't we kick it off with a question? Who is Sanjay Jain?
Okay. Sanjay Jain is a small town boy. I was born and grew up in a small town called Muzaffarnagar. It is north of Delhi, 120 kilometers. I did my schooling from there. Was never serious about my studies. I love fun. I love traveling. I have a lot of gratitude towards God. He has given me more than what I expected. And often people think I'm serious, but the moment they spend more time, they find I'm not really that serious. In my house, people say I'm the elder kid in the family. that's what my daughter says.
Very cool. It's kind of interesting. Finance people, just given the nature of their profession, they come across as quite rigid, maybe, or quite buttoned up. But from inside, it's quite different. Would love to know, how did you first foray into this world of finance? Coming up from Muzaffarnagar, did you have any role models that you look up to say, hey, this is something that is interesting, I want to go and do this? Or there was some other kind of serendipitous event that happened that led you to get your first introduction to finance?
So it's quite a interesting story. I did my 12th from a science background and always wanted to go to Delhi hostel, not really to make a career, but to enjoy life. And I landed up in Hansraj hostel. I always wanted to do maths because I was good at maths. I got admission into Delhi University, but I didn't get the hostel. I got admission into Hindu. I could not get hostel. Hansraj gave me an hostel and the course was chemistry honors. So obviously chemistry was never my first choice. And nevertheless, since hostel was there, I went forward, enrolled myself. First year was total party, Rohit, to the extent that, you know, we were sitting in the month of February and one of our seniors came and he said, they used to call us Fachas. They said, Fachas, do you want to spend 2 more years in the hostel or not? And, you know, that's one. It really shook us that exams are around the corner. Whatever we could study in 2-3 weeks, the first paper went. And it was horrible. Horrible to the extent that I thought, I'll just quit and I will not give rest to the people because it was very, very bad. But my roommate, he's now an MD with one of the largest private equity firms. He said, Sanjay, there is no downside. Why don't you give all the papers and then relax at home? And I said, okay, sir, nothing worse can happen. I gave all the papers. I went back in summer holidays to my hometown. And in hearts and hearts, I knew that I'm going to fly. And when the paper result came, I asked my brother-in-law, I said, why don't you go and see what the result is? And he went, he said, you have flunked. So, somewhere there was a hope that I might pass. Then I called him again. I said, why don't you go and tell me how many marks did I get? And it was a little unclear. So next day morning, I went to Delhi, went to the college, and I saw the result sheet. And I don't know why, I somehow passed the first division. So that's when I think I started getting a little more about studies, finished my chemistry honors, never wanted to pursue chemistry as such. And so I said, let's leave science and let's do something which can help me do business. I come from a background where studies were never given preference. All 3-4 generations of my parents and forefathers were into business. So with that mindset, I thought, let me take up CA and it'll help me to, you know, get a little more understanding of business, of industry, of funding, of finance. And that's how I landed up into the field of finance.
Got it. So you got enrolled into Chartered Accountancy course and went through that. I guess at that point in time, it was a 3-year kind of thing.
It was a 3-year internship. Yeah.
Right.
I took 4 years to clear my CA.
Got it. And then you joined the industry.
Yeah, then I joined the industry because as I was studying and I was auditing a lot of corporates, helping them raise funds, I realized that it is not my cup of tea, as setting a business has so many dimensions. Finance is just one part, you know, taking care of manufacturing, taking care of production, taking care of sales. And I thought I'm not ready for it. And then I took up a job. I was fortunate I got a first job with Oswalds. And they are the big group in Punjab, not anymore, but they had multiple industries. So I took up an assignment with them and in a joint venture, which was in Manipur. No one used to go there. So they thought, this is a new facha, let's send him there. Manipur used to be a disturbed state. So they said, you'll be head of finance there in the factory and you know, you take care of factory and stuff like that. So that's how I landed up with my first job.
Interesting. And this is what year are we talking?
We're talking about 91, 92 types.
Got it. So back then, I guess as MBAs are much more prevalent and you can call it maybe much more in fashion, was there any thought that, hey, kind of I've done CA, now maybe let me work for a few years and then I'll go and do an MBA, or let me directly go MBA? Was there any thought around MBA at all? Or you wanted to just continue on the path in the industry itself?
So honestly, during that time, CA was a far more fitter profession if you want to go into industry. MBA trains you for finance, for how finance can impact the business on the strategy side. But CA, my belief is it is far more holistic. You know, it gives you an insight about taxation, direct and indirect. It teaches you about strategy. It teaches you about computers and systems. So I think it is far more holistic. So it never crossed my mind that, you know, I need to take an additional degree.
And before we kind of go further into your background, what do you think about that distinction now, CA versus MBA? Is one better versus the other? Should people do both? It seems to me like just overkilling by doing both, but a lot of people are doing it. What's your view on that?
I mean, I think doing both the courses is definitely an overkill. I think it is, I mean, if you look at MNCs, there they prefer to hire MBAs for finance. But if you look at Indian companies, they still, most of the CFOs are still chartered accountants. So, because when you work in an MNC, your role is very, very different as compared to your role in an Indian conglomerate. In an Indian conglomerate, you tend to head multiple functions. You know, you will probably take care of tax, you'll be involved in strategy, you'll take care of finance, you'll take care of controllership. Whereas when you are an MNC, it is kind of silo, you know, wherein you look at finance and you advise value addition with respect to finance. Generally, that's what I've seen in my tenure with Turner International or with Viacom.
Got it. So tell us then, from Oswal to how did your entry into this whole media industry happen, where you have spent almost 20 years of your career as a CFO?
So, before we go there, let me share a nice instance about my first job. So I landed up in Imphal and I realized that it's a disturbed area. I never knew how bad it is. And we used to all stay in one big hotel. So the Oswalds had taken one big hotel converted into a guest house, only where the staff, senior staff used to live. And obviously 80% of the senior staff had gone away because of insurgency. So practically, other than finance, I took care of sales. I oversee the production. Like it was a kind of a CEO role and I really loved it. I didn't know how to drive. There were 3 cars at my disposal. So that is where I learned driving also. So when I was taking care of sales, a lot of intermediate people got cut out. So there were a lot of leakages there in the factory, maybe because of necessity of the insurgency. And 2 months later, my wife was supposed to land. Because she said, we're just 1 year in marriage and how can we live separately? And the day she landed, there was 5 or 6 terrorists which came to the guest house and they said, where is Sunday? And they were all loaded with guns. You could see, the caretaker said, you know, you could see guns flopping from the jackets. And they left a note for me saying that we'll come tomorrow. Please keep an X amount ready. So that was, I was taken aback. I called the promoter. I said, this is what has happened. So he said, he very kindly said, give him the money. I said, give him the money. What if he fires a bullet? I said, no, I'm not going to stay here. So he said, why don't you take it off? Go for 7 days to Shillong and then we'll talk. So that night, obviously, you know, when you have to travel from Imphal to Shillong, there is Nagaland, which comes in between. And during that time, if you had to cross Nagaland, you need to have a permit. And obviously, there was no time for a permit. So there was a local guy who was a cashier, who was my confidant, and you know, we had struck well. He was a lookalike. So I told him all the story. He said, you should move and don't tell anyone that you're going to leave. So I called the driver. I said, sleep in the guest house. And early in the morning, 4 o'clock, we went to the factory, filled up the petrol, and I left for Shillong. At the Nagaland border, they stopped and they said, where is your permit? Fortunately, when my wife was coming on flight from, she took a flight from Calcutta, her co-passenger was a minister in Manipur state. So he had given his card to Manisha, my wife. So we used his card and managed to go through Nagaland. So I then came back to Bukania in a sugar factory at the factory level.
So you never went back to...
I never went back. I was very clear that I will not take risk on my life.
Of course.
So from there, I spent 2 years, 2.5 years at the unit. I learned various nuances of sugar industry. Since my bent always used to be business oriented, I used to look at, you know, every process can be more efficient, you know, how the cost can go down, how the revenue can go up. That used to be at the back of my mind. Obviously, control ratio function was always there. So somehow from there, I was shifted to head office in Bukirin Papers, which was expanding in a big way. Then landed up at Panacea Biotech, which was a pharma company. But, you know, manufacturing companies, Rohit, they don't pay you well. Once I was in Delhi, I started looking at service industries. And I was looking at various options and I got entry into media. My first job with media was Zeeturner. So they did a joint venture with Zee and they wanted to set up a distribution arm. And that is how I landed up in media, never came out of media after that.
You have seen multiple different types of media companies during your time. Can you maybe tell us how do you characterize that industry in general, maybe even talk about the evolution in terms of what have you seen over the last 20, 25 odd years in terms of the evolution of media in India?
Yeah, I think media has gone through a tremendous change. I mean, from all perspectives, you know, from distribution perspective, earlier the distribution used to happen only through cable, then satellite, television came, DTH came, you know, that became the second mode of distribution. And then over the internet, OTT came. In terms of content, I mean, everything has changed. You know, when I entered the media, I think there were only 2-3 big players. Star was there and Zee was there. And there were a couple of entertainment channels. They used to do 14-15 hours of original programming. And obviously, they were quite profitable because both of them pretty much had the monopoly. There were very few news channels. I think Aaj Tak was the only news channel which was there. I don't remember any other news channel. And then the mushrooming happened in the industry. Suddenly, we saw almost 50-60 news channels. There were 15-20 news channels in Hindi and English, and there were almost 30-40 regional news channels. We saw mushrooming of entertainment channels, of Bollywood movie channels. So in every genre, in music channels, today we have almost over 500 channels. And since there are so many channels, the competition is intense. Because to fill the pipeline, you need that much content. And it's a creative industry wherein you can't manufacture content like a factory. You need creative minds who can write interesting stories, who know the pulse of the people. And maybe that's the reason if you look at any channel, there are 2-3 shows do well and balanced shows don't do well. Like, as you say, Ramesh Sippy made Shole and after that he could never make a Shole. So
it's very similar to your VC model. It seems like the law of averages or the power law really comes into picture here.
Yeah, you never know what is going to become a hit. And of recently, I mean, then everyone started focusing on subscription revenue. The regulator did a lot of changes. They thought that channels are acting a little monopolistically. They are not treating the consumer fairly. They came with a number of regulations. They started capping the maximum price. They laid rules on how you can bundle, how you cannot bundle. But overall, the industry kept growing. Ad revenue kept growing. Subscription kept growing. And now, I mean, look at now on the digital side, almost every media house has a digital presence. They have a digital platform. And digital advertisement is probably bigger than the television advertisement market. So yes, I mean, there's a lot of change. From appointment viewing, we are now view on demand. Whenever you want to see, whatever you want to see, you can see through an OTT play. Yeah. So it has been an interesting journey.
It's kind of interesting. It seems like Indian consumers have unsatiable demand for content. Like, whatever you throw at them, they'll keep on consuming untiringly. Maybe it's just the sheer number of people that we have in our country, or something else. It just kind of bamboozles my mind in terms of how much content is India consuming.
See, okay, so let me split this question into two parts. Obviously, the content viewing is going up in terms of number of hours being spent by each individual. The number of people viewing content is growing up because the data has become cheap. Television penetration, whatever was there, is there. The growth in that is not too much. But OTT penetration is going up by the day. But, I mean, today, though a lot of content is being generated, to discover a content is still a challenge. So now, if someone makes a content, the first challenge is where to put it. I mean, there are only 2-3 platforms which are very popular. You know, where if you put, you will get viewing. But if you don't go to those platforms, how will that content get discovered? So that's a challenge. Obviously, good content will find its way sooner or later. Okay, but again, making good content is not easy. So, yeah. So definitely, consumption is going up, but discovery is definitely a challenge for a new guy.
Makes sense. As I look at media, it feels from outside, at least, that it is quite a capital-intensive business. Has it always been the case, and thereby only large business houses kind of really play in this market, or there is a nuance there where even emerging players can come up and really disrupt, let's say, maybe a TV channel market or some other kind of a media industry market?
So, Rohit, this is again a very tricky question. Huh? So if you look at the basic business, actually, it does not need too much money because, I mean, if you need 15 hours, if you want to run a TV channel, the main constituent of that is your content. Now, if you look at content, if you want to produce 15 hours, 16 hour week content, that may not cost you too much. But the point is that if you want to put Bollywood movies onto that, that costs a lot. I mean, they act as a marketing tool because they will attract a lot of viewers onto your channel. And what you try is that you want to use that platform to let your fiction work from where you make money. But the challenge has started is that distribution has become very, very tricky, Rohit. Today, we have almost 500 channels. Now, if you want to get distributed and if you want to get placed in a band which is very easily viewable, that becomes very expensive. Earlier, that never used to happen. I mean, now every cable operator who has a sizable muscle to get listed on this platform, though a lot of regulations are there, it is not. So that has made the business very expensive. So actually, it is, I mean, initially, you first couple of years, you will keep funding the loss. So from that extent, you need deep pockets now. A common man, a common industrialist or a business house, not possible for him to enter media. I mean, you need very, very deep pockets. It has become a big boys game now.
Are there any specific new media models that you are liking that you think has real good potential of disrupting the established models?
See, MX Player tried. You know, he came with an OTT model, putting a lot of content, a lot of good content. But what has happened is that, I mean, he wanted, it was always free. So he wanted to monetize through advertisement. But now if you watch content on MX Player, the advertisement keep coming after every 5-7 minutes. So that's a very irritating factor. So in today's environment, I think one should wait a little bit more. OTT is a very easy model to, I mean, it's easy to make content and put it on OTT platforms, but you will not be able to get viewership. How will people discover about you? So you'll end up spending 5x, 10x of your content cost only in marketing. So if you put that kind of money to get eyeballs, how will you make money? So at the moment, and that's the reason why if you look, there is so much of consolidation which has happened in the media. So today, pretty much it's going to become a duopoly. I mean, Star and Reliance or Viacom is getting merged. And Sony and Zee were at one point talking to get merged. That merger fell through. But there is no other player on the entertainment space which is left, at least on the Hindi language. And if you look at regional languages, pretty much there are 1, 2, 3 players, not more than that. So in that sense, market is getting consolidated, which is good in a way, because industry had been bleeding for quite long. Only 5% of the channels used to make money. Now at least more sense will prevail in the industry.
Are there any sliver of the market that you have seen over time that you feel is still untapped and there might be an interesting business to be created?
So, Doordarshan used to always be a free platform to be consumed by tier 4, tier 5 or the deepest pockets of the country, rural pockets. Even they have realized the power of distribution and penetration. Now, they also sell slots by auction. So that used to be one space wherein you can put good content, maybe a used content, which has already been run on your main channel, and you can distribute free and make money on it as well. So every big player has started doing that. And DD has realized the power of its penetration. Now even that comes with a price. So they auction their slots for 1 year, 2 year, 3 year at a ridiculous price. But yes, that pocket is still there. Connected TV is, I think, another market which is going to grow. So televisions will come with bundled channels, with bundled OTT play. So it is plug and play. A lot of people with AI coming in, with people becoming richer, they are taking early retirements. With AI, there will be a lot of redundancies. So television or content consumption is going to grow for people to pass time, people to spend time. And connected TVs will play a role. I think that market is still emerging. There could be a good play along with connected television, to e-commerce, to video commerce or social commerce. I think that area also is likely to grow as against a pure Amazon play.
Interesting. I was kind of thinking through in terms of, how many news channels do we have? And it doesn't seem like we have those many news coming out of the country to be able to fill up all of those slots. And perhaps that's why there has been a lot of sensationalization of news, right? And we spoke about Aaj Tak a little bit. Perhaps Aaj Tak was a culprit in making that happen as well, right? Everything was kind of flashed into your face. So even if you don't want to believe it, you kind of just hear it 50 times in 15 minutes that you your brain gets attuned to think about it in a certain way. Do you have any personal views on that kind of sensationalization versus just putting out the facts of here is what it is?
See, the fact is, Rohit, all news channels are for commercial purpose, right? They're there to make money. They are not public broadcasters. The public broadcasters, generally people think, carry a biased news. They don't carry independent news, correct? That's one part of the story. Number two, if there are 30 channels, how do you get a viewership? Well, you have to do something which quickly attracts the viewers. So you have no choice but to sensationalize. If you look at actual journalism, each story takes a lot of time if you want to do a good story. Now, if you spend 10 man-days to make one half-an-hour story, it becomes a very costly affair. How many journalists you'll have? How many stories will you create? And these deep-dive journalistic stories, how many people will have interest in it other than intellectual? So I think trend is my friend. So whatever people want, that's what news channels flash. If you want to listen to Modi, they'll wrap around story around Modi. If you want to listen to some communal stuff, they'll put some communal stuff. And the idea is to get viewership and to make money. So journalistic standards, according to me, are not what they were 20 years, 30 years back. But I think that happens in every country. Had there been only 2-3 channels, obviously then everyone would have focused on quality. Because viewership would have come in any case.
Makes sense. You've been CFO for almost 20 years. How do you think about leadership?
I think leadership is all about backing your team, believing in your team, getting the right guys to do the right stuff, standing by them. You need to have a vision. You need to be collaborative in approach. Obviously, leadership is very, very important because that shapes the future of an organization. Did I get the question right, Rohit? Or I'm deviating from...
No, makes sense. Yeah, okay. How the expectations from a CFO changed over time, and how did you mold yourself to meet or exceed those expectations as a CFO?
See, as the competition goes up in every genre, I mean, India started opening up since 1990. You saw a lot of businesses coming up, a lot of competition coming up, a lot of market getting open. There was a lot of opportunities. Multiple people came. Now, when there is a competition, then obviously you need your systems to be more efficient. You need to be more ready to have a better strategy to penetrate the market and to move up. So with the change in the industrial scenario, earlier a CFO used to be a controllership, an accountant, and a tax guy. His job was pretty much, you please arrange the funding, what the company needs, take care of financial controllership, and take care of taxation department. But as the competition grew, CFO, see, my belief is that CFO today, since it's a funnel of an organization, everything comes to finance, from marketing, from sales, from every department, from production, they have insight into every function. And they come out, they look at everything with a very different perspective. And if you have a business orient in your head, if you have a business mindset in your head, you'll be able to see what is going wrong in which function, whether it is production, is it wastage mode, is it consumption of electricity mode. On the sales side, since you are number driven, you know what competition is doing. So you can give strategic inputs almost in every function as to how to improve, how to reduce cost, how to be more efficient, how to have a cheaper funding. So today, even the leadership at the top, they would like their CFOs to be a sounding board to help them tell where the leakages are, where inefficiencies are, how the company can move forward. So, you know, you CFO today are the best sounding board for any leadership. They have started adding value almost in every function because probably they are the only one other than the CEO who has insights into every function. So over time, the function has evolved. It has become more a value-added function, a strategic function, rather than a controlling function.
How do you go about learning those aspects, right? Let's say when you started out, or when, let's say, someone is kind of junior, they perhaps have one particular focus area, maybe accounts receivables or payables or taxes or reporting or MIS, something like that, right? How should one think about zoning out of that one particular area, maybe getting experience in others, but at the same time also kind of leveling up themselves to be able to say, hey, I'm ready for that strategic advisory to the rest of the functions, really kind of, you know, providing that business partnership that one would look for?
See, 90% of the time, Rohit, it depends on how much hunger you have. Because if you don't have a hunger, you will not strive for more. You know, it is about going for the kill. You need more. You need to grow. And that drives the inertia. Even if you're an MIS function, when you're making an MIS, you will know exactly, either from the past history, statistics, or competition, as to what is going wrong in the company. You can add value then, that, you know, why the wastage is going up, why the steam consumption is more, why my realization is down when the industry is going up. You need to put in extra hours to know what the competition is doing, how the industry is moving, so to form an opinion as to where your company stands. And if you give value adds, suppose even if you're junior in the system, even if you're looking at tax, if you are adding value and showing that value to your seniors, you will be on top of the mind for the next promotion or the next responsibility. And that is how you keep growing. Even when you reach the top position in the finance function as a CFO, you need to then collaborate with your peers. I mean, when you interact with marketing, you need to learn, you need to unlearn and learn as to what they do, how they measure themselves with respect to output and input, how you can help them, tell them what may not be working. It may sound very weird, but that is what you have to do. And once you learn what the business is, what the triggers of business are with respect to cost and revenue, what could differentiate in the business, you will start adding value in all the functions. I mean, business generally is common sense. It is not rocket science. So more time you spend, the better understanding you will have of the business.
You have seen so many different industries before finally landing on the media side. And within media itself, it's quite varied in terms of the flavors of media that it has. how do you think about finance as a function that does not really need to specialize in any particular industry as such, and can be much more horizontal in terms of the capabilities that one can bring from one industry to the other?
I think the basic function of finance and controllership and tax and funding, that is pretty much common across all the industries. Now, within that, if we talk about, say, funding, different industries will have a different working capital cycle, which is not difficult to understand and learn. There's a customer credit which you give. You look at how much lead time is required for inventory, how much inventory you want to keep. So you can figure out what is the funding requirement of an organization. So that may differ. But the basic principle across all the industries in the finance function remains pretty much common. But as you move up in the ladder and you are at a senior position, at a strategic position, then changing industries becomes a little difficult, because anyone who's hiring someone at the top position would always prefer someone from industry. He would like that, let someone bring the industry knowledge and use that knowledge to add value in the industry. They may not prefer a candidate from a different industry, because there'll be a 6 month, 1 year learning curve. So yes, at a mid level, you can move across the industries. And that is when my take is that you should decide in which industry you want to be. Because once you reach the top position, you can keep moving within that industry here and there, or you know, something which is closer to industry, but a 360 degree may be very, very difficult.
What instigated you to move from one CFO position in the media industry to another CFO position? Compensation is something that, of course, comes along with it, but I got to believe that can't really be the driving factor when you were kind of already at that CFO scale, right? So what was sort of your motivation? And you kind of made 2 to 3 switches, right, as a CFO itself. Was it the size? Was it the culture? Was it the opportunity? What did you look for in the moves that you made as a CFO?
So my first job in media was Zturner. So Zturner was a pure distribution company, you know, where you could not have added much value, because you are taking channels as a partner and you're distributing. So suddenly from manufacturing, when I came to distribution company, I thought there is, other than controllership, I hardly have any job. There is very little value add which you can do. So obviously I wasn't happy with my move, but yes, it gave me a better compensation. So 6 months in job, I started looking out and I got my opportunity with Aztec. So Aztec was a fabulous assignment. I really loved it. I was there almost 5 years. It was the leading news channel. They went through the IPO under my belt. So you know, I was proud to be part of the company at that time. It's a different experience. You know, you road shows, you interact with analysts, you meet a lot of people from industry. And obviously I was enjoying my stint. Then, you know, after 4 or 5 years, you look at what next. So from news, the next big thing was entertainment. I mean, you want to move to a bigger size company. So this opportunity of Imagine KF, Imagine NDTV, Imagine was a joint venture between NDTV, Universal Studios, and Sameer Nair, who was the next CEO of Star. So they were about to launch an entertainment channel. And that's how I moved to Bombay with an entertainment channel. So even that was a nice journey. As I said, the scales changed. Because 6 months into the launch, Colors came in, and Colors came in with double amount in the kitty. So they changed the game with respect to pumping a lot of money on distribution on Bollywood movies. So as a result, our burn went up. Both the channels are burning. NDTV had limited resources to put money, so we ran into troubles, and that's when we started looking for a new partner, so to say. Turner stepped in. So Turner bought over the stake from Universal Studios and NDTV. And Turner essentially was a very conservative company. They run kids business in the country. Kids business is a very small business, and it's a very profitable business. So suddenly from a profitable business to a large business, which was guzzling money. So eventually that went down. Unfortunately, we all had decent equity stakes in that. And then I took up this assignment with IndiaCast, which was again a joint venture between TV18 and Viacom18. It was again into distribution. But the additional part was that it had all the digital rights. It had the international business under them. Entire international business from all perspectives were managed by IndiaCast. So it became an interesting assignment. And I spent almost the longest tenure of my career in IndiaCast.
Very cool. Tell us, what did you like about the CFO role the most?
You get to interact with all the peers. You get to know about all the functions of the entity. You feel that you are being part of the growth. You are, in a way, from a backseat driving growth. And I think you can foresee what's going to happen to the company much before others can. So to that extent, you have a crystal ball in your hand. You can influence our decisions at all levels, right from the board to the CEO to a functional head. That power, CFO drives that kind of power.
Very cool. What did you like the least?
So sitting with auditors and scratching the head.
I'm sure. Do you have three commandments maybe that you would suggest for any successful CFO?
I would say that you need to be a team player, inwardly and outwardly, so peers and within your team. You need to have a desire to learn the business in whichever industry you're going. And God has given you 2 ears and one tongue, so listen more, speak less.
Awesome. Why don't we now move to some of the different stints that you have had? You spoke about Ajta. Tell us more about the whole IPO event that happened with the company. Of course, it was the number one running news channel for a number of years. I don't think anyone in India has not seen Ajta. How was that journey? How was the decision to IPO really happened? And kind of as a CFO, what did you think that the role that you really played in that whole event?
See, Ajta is such a big brand that, you know, when you talk about news, when you think about news, only thing which comes to mind is Ajta. It's like when you think about toothpaste, Colgate comes in mind. So Ajta is actually a big, big brand. Till the time I was there, I'm sure now also, it's very, very professionally run. Promoters don't interfere. Editorial guys are given complete freedom. It's a pretty much board-run company. So when I joined, there were a couple of private equity guys who had invested, and they wanted an exit. Obviously, there were timelines as to, you know, when exit has to be given. We still had enough time. There was no need to hurry up for an IPO. We wanted to expand. When I joined, we only had one Hindi channel. So we had launched an English channel called Headlines Today at that point of time. We were trying to differentiate by only telecasting headlines and not deeper stories, because that would have made a very cost-effective model, because Ajta is already collecting news. You don't have to do a on-ground English reported stuff. You know, you convert that into headlines, put a good anchor and run a channel. Because most of the guys actually only want to listen to 90% time headlines. So with that concept, headline was launched. There was a local channel called Delhi Ajta got launched. And this is, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 2004 or 5. 2004. So there were no IPOs for the last almost 12 months. The market was pretty dry. When Ajta thought about doing the IPO, we spoke to a couple of merchant bankers. And we finally, I still remember for a small IPO like Ajta, Uday Kotak came for a pitch. I saw Uday Kotak for the first time. Renuka Kamath came for the pitch. So we finally hired J.M. Morgan Stanley, Kotak and ICICI Securities as a merchant banker. They were all very excited because they said, after a long, long time, I think we were the second media company to hit the IPO. There was no one on the news side which got listed. So everyone was very excited.
A lot of scarcity value as well then.
Yeah, a lot of scarcity value. And it was a profitable venture. It was making money. So obviously your role was to interact with a lot of analysts. Tell them what the value is so that they can write a good report, a genuine report, what you think is right, because that is what fetches you value in terms of perception and putting money on the table. Obviously, then it involved a lot of roadshows. There was enough appetite within the country, so we did not do too many overseas roadshows. It was a small IPO. We got subscribed, I think, almost 100 times or 50 times. I don't exactly remember the number. We heavily got oversubscribed. So, yeah. So, essentially, to give an exit to existing guys, Bharti was invested. I mean, Sunil Bharti used to be on our board. So, I don't know, directly, or G Capital was there on our board. ICICI, private equity had invested. So they also needed an exit. So that's how IPO happened. Yeah.
what's your recommendation in terms of preparation that a company needs to do before going IPO?
See, I mean, first of all, you need to have a good track record because that brings credibility of what you're saying. And number two, if you're looking at value, you need to have a good plan. That good plan could be on the basis of raising money as well, but it has to be a credible plan which can, where the investors are ready to buy that story. You know, it's a good company, it has a good track record. With additional funding, they have a good plan, the profit will multiply. There's enough room for growth, there's enough appetite for consuming their product. So those two are essential things. Then obviously your compliances have to be in place. Your audit has to be clean. So I mean, once you have a house in order with respect to your compliances, with respect to your data, with respect to your numbers, I think from finance perspective, you're pretty much set. Then how good the story is will define how best investors will take it.
Do you have a preference between public versus private company? If you would have a choice, would you still go public or would you remain private?
It depends upon the objective of the promoter or of the organization. If you are generating enough cash and your growth plan can be funded by that, why will you go public? Because the moment you go public, you have taken public money. You are accountable for that. You have to be a lot more transparent. You are playing with third party's money. So, you know, you cannot afford to take that many gamble or risky bets. So it depends upon what the growth path or journey of each organization is. But if there is a lot of room for growth and your internal capital is not good enough, obviously you don't want to wait for 2-3 years for internal growth to happen because that may even miss the bus. Then you look at taking growth capital, either through an IPO or through a private equity, to fuel the growth and not to miss upon the opportunity. So let me put it in another way. You know, if there's a growth waiting there with a decent outlook for a couple of years, one should look at raising growth capital and moving forward. Because otherwise someone else will take it.
Makes sense. You have had exposure to the radio side of media as well and sold a channel to Sun. Can you tell us how did that sort of come about? And I heard that the negotiations were, let's just say, not that straightforward.
Okay. So basically, radio was opening up in the country. FM radio was something very, very new. So everyone was very, very gung-ho, especially only the media guys knew about it. So almost every media player wanted to bid for licenses. Obviously, India Today also bid it. We got the licenses. Everyone did a similar stuff of playing Bollywood songs. So India Today came out with the thought that, you know, let's make it a woman oriented channel. So I think it was branded as Meow, and the focus was to get more women audience. Again, when there are 10, 20, 30, 40 channels, and each channel operates in a small territory, revenue can't be very huge. You know, your listenership, there were no mechanisms at that point of time to measure listenership. So listenership measure used to happen only by recall value. Unlike in TV industry, the viewership gets measured by actual number of people doing it. So they have people meters in various houses. This is that they extrapolate. But audience listenership used to get measured by recall value. So obviously, the rates which at that point of time, radio channels were commanding were very low. So, and the licensing was quite high. So obviously, we were not making money. And Aaj Tak being a news channel had limited resources. So we said, why not let go of this business? So obviously, we internally knew that, you know, we may not have funds to rent for 6 months. And we were in discussions with Sun. And we were quoting a price, which was at a premium, you know. And we didn't sell it cheap. We sold it at a premium, recovered all the losses. We made money on our investments. And at one point, Sun said they wanted 20 crore discount. Okay. They wanted some discount. And obviously, in my head, I was trying to convince my guys that, you know, let's negotiate somewhere in between and let's close it because we may not have funds to rent for 5 months. But the lesson which I learned is that, you know, you need to put a poker face, you know, it's a Russian roulette, have some balls. If you give a discount of 10%, what if we ask for another 10%, what will you do? And we ended up selling at that price at what we wanted. And the learning was that, you know, you have to be tough when you're negotiating. You need to understand the need of a buyer who's sitting on the table, how desperate he is, what all his other options are. And once you have a little insight, you can command your pressure point. And that learning went a long way when I headed business in India Cast. I looked after international business for almost a year and a half, and believe me, it helped me a lot. I had turned around a number of deals that people thought will never come around.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you're kind of walking the other person's shoes in some manner, and then really taking your judgment call based on that understanding.
80-90% of the time, people only think from their perspective. They never get into other person's shoes and look at what he can do, what all fallback he has. Obviously, you need to be a little careful about your fallbacks. But if you get into other person's shoes, life becomes a little easier.
Makes sense. Let's talk a little more about the NDTV Imagine saga. Seems like, of course, started out with a lot of flair. Then colors came in and kind of, I would say, added fuel, much needed fuel to the fire. But then kind of, it was one of those, rise up fast, but then also came to the ground quick kind of a story, right? Were there specific learnings from that? Could you have gone slowly and that would have actually steadied the ship and ultimately kind of made money and, you know, the brand and the channels would have lived on? Could it have been like, what really went wrong and what really went right in your mind? And what did you take out of it?
Channel, when it was launched, it did pretty well. I think in the first 4-5 months, we did 800 GRPs, which was a big number. And to start making good money, one had to get to a number of 175, 200 types GRP. So you had to double your viewership from where you were. So initial 4-6 months took us to almost halfway through. And the going was good. I think we were sitting with some $30 million, $40 million cash still in value. And colors came in. We used to do some 12, 13 hours of programming. So your cost is defined by how many hours of programming you do, because rest of the cost is pretty much fixed. Distribution was not all that complicated, to be honest. People wanted good content, so they carried us with a small cost, not much. So everything was going good, and colors came in. Now, anyone who's a late entrant has to do a big stunt to become attractive, right? Like Jio came, they took the rates so down, then the existing two players started feeling the heat. Vodafone today is struggling to survive. So similar story happened. So colors came with almost 16 hours of content. So we had to increase 25-30% of content, which means added cost. Colors wanted everyone to view. So what they did was on distribution, they took the most prime bands. Cable operators realized that there is a value in a placement. If they are putting the channel right on the EPG on the front page, and they threw a lot of money on that. So they suddenly got a lot of eyeballs. Since they were new, they blew up a lot of money on advertising. So the eyeballs were limited, right? Content consumption hours were limited. So they were eating into everyone's share. So the guys who were on the top, like Star, Sony, Z, even if the 5-5% went, it didn't make any difference to them. But if 10% of our viewership went down, it made a lot of difference to us. Because suddenly we lost 25% of viewership. Then they further upped the game by putting the top Bollywood movie. They used to buy movies at whatever cost available, because most of the movies used to sit in the library of Z stars only. So they had to pay a premium to get movies. We never believed in putting movies because movies never made sense. But again, like Jio, they wanted an entry, they wanted penetration. They were the last players. They did everything what needed to be done. So we started running out of cash. So we started, NDTV obviously had said that our financials can't support. So we started looking for a new buyer. New buyer came with a limited capital. They said they are willing to risk X amount of capital. So now we had two options, right? Either do a slow burn and see what happens to the competition. They probably will slow down at some point of time. So you have another day to fight. Or do a big, big stunt. And if that works, maybe the turnaround will happen. So a big stunt happened, but turnaround didn't happen. So that's the life. You never know what is right, what is wrong, but that is how the saga unfolded.
Of your time as the CFO, I'm sure you have seen a lot of strategies and a lot of execution behind those strategies. In your mind, do you emphasize one versus the other a little more? As in, what I'm trying to ask is, have you seen more strategies failing or more execution failing?
So if I talk about media, we can separate media into two parts. One is content and one is business, other than content. So in content, actually, you can look at a lot of data. You can look at what is working for competition. You can do story bouncing in a lot of cities, when say 2000, bounce story, whether they like it or not. So you do all that research, you do a lot of research, but you can never be sure that it's going to work or not. So on the content side, it is more gut. I think this is going to work. So it may work, it may not work. So it is gambled to an extent. I mean, in a span of 6 months, I think, if I'm not mistaken, we would have launched some 12, 13 shows. One after another. Because you never know what people will like. You know, they might be, so like for example, there was a show on Colors called, it was the longest running show on the Indian diaspora called, it's a child marriage show it was. I'm missing the name.
Was it Balika Vadhu?
Balika Vadhu. Show was in the market for 3 years and no one was willing to touch it. No one was willing to touch it because they thought it's a concept which is not going to work in prospering country. People are aspiring for more. This content will not work. So no one touched that content. Colors bought that because they were new on the block. They were unable to fill the pipeline, to my understanding. So they said, let's take this show. They put all the marketing monies on a patriotic show and on other shows. And Malika Vadhu worked, rest of the things didn't work. And so Malika Vadhu became the most successful show ever on television. So such is life. So on the content side, you never know what's going to work. It is my gut against your gut. But on the rest of the business, it is strategy which works, you know, as to how you want to pitch to an advertiser, how you want to structure your rates, how you want to structure your deals, how you want to distribute, how you want to negotiate with a particular operator. Because overseas, most of the deals are negotiated. So a lot of strategy works there. A lot of science works there. But on the content side, it is like tossing a coin. It is my hunch against your hunch. And you can do a lot of data, a lot of science, a lot of research, which everyone does. But my experience is that no one knows what's going to work. Everyone wants every show to be successful, but it never happens.
Interesting. And I guess that's why I've read even the likes of Netflix aren't really able to produce as many blockbuster originals in India as they have been able to do in many other countries across the world.
So there is also another psyche. You know, if any producer who is given to the show, you would like to buy him. You know, you believe that he'll be able to give you another hit. But that has never happened. Because, you know, what content you produce, maybe there was scarcity of the content at that point of time. People liked it. Maybe the actor who you picked up did a great job, even if it was a small name. And something works which no one knows what will work. Because if someone knows what is working, he'll be able to give simultaneous hits. And that has never happened in history.
I think only one genre that kind of keeps on, it's like a gift that keeps on giving, is the mythological side, right? You can have like a new Ramayan built up. You can have a new Mahabharata built up. That seems to be working at least a little bit, if not even become like a blockbuster.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's religion, right? And religion works across the globe. I mean, 80% of the world works on religion, right?
Cool.
It has always worked. And that's the reason you will find mythological shows on every channel. No matter how progressive the channel is, you will find some mythological shows there.
Makes sense. Why don't we now move to the life after retirement? You have been retired for like a year now, a little more, 2 years. How has been the experience? Are you liking it, or are you kind of more bored because you're out of your day-to-day grill, maybe?
Okay, so let me give an answer in a little different way. I think I've been thinking, so I come from a very small town. I never thought I'll reach where I've reached. I mean, I have a lot of gratitude to God for what I've been able to, not that I've done anything great, but whatever I've been, wherever I've been, I have a lot of, I mean, it is with the blessings of God. I could not have done it and managed it. So since last 5-6 years, I mean, I'm a number guy. I know my needs very clearly. I don't need a bigger house. I don't need a bigger car. So obviously, if your needs are going up, your money need will always keep going up. So I had whatever I needed, I had put it in black and white. You know, this is what my needs are. And when I thought I have enough money to take care of that, and I have enough money to take care of contingencies, in my head, I was fine to take off from an active corporate life. So that happened almost 5 or 6 years back. But again, you know, if a monthly paycheck keeps coming into your bank, you don't want that to go away. And you always have a fear as to what you will do, how will your time go by, when what will you do after retirement? I mean, you can't be sitting idle at home and getting rotted. So I think COVID helped a lot. When COVID happened, we spent almost 2 years working from home. In reality, I mean, at a senior level, you don't work 12 hours a day, right? So I realized that it is not really all that different. And that's when I started summing up my head that, you know, it's okay. Also, you know, as you grow old, Rohit, you realize that every stress has an impact on your body. After an age, everything starts affecting your body. And whatever you don't have, you start valuing more. You know, when you don't have money, you value money a lot. You know, when you are not at the top of your career, you want growth in your career. So I started realizing that, you know, I may have only 10, 12, 15 years of good health. So why not do things what I always want to do and could not do because of lack of money? So we purposely decided that, you know, let's follow our passion. Let's do, obviously money is important, but let's focus on other things also. As against spending 80% time in making money and 20% on sales, let's reverse that. So now I spend 80% time on my passion and 20% time on making money. So that's how the decision became easier. And once the decision was made, I mean, we like a lot of travel. We like travel. So we try to do a bit of travel. Last 2-3 years, we almost have done like 90 to 100 days of travel in a year. I like stock market. So that keeps me busy for 3 hours a day. It keeps my gray sense a little active and alive because whichever company you're invested, you tend to read, you tend to know what the business is. I mean, you look at numbers, you look at stock price. And apart from that, I'm part of an angel group. So new businesses keep coming and pitching us. It keeps telling you what is happening, what are the new trends in the market. Again, to primarily, money making is a secondary objective. To stay active at head is a primary objective. So it has served well so far. It helps you to meet new people. You know, it helps you to network. So far, the journey has been good. I miss sometimes meeting new people. So that I miss. So I try every week, I try to meet 2-3 people from the industry, from the new sphere. I try to socialize more, which I never used to do earlier. So far it is good.
Do you think in retirement, one should have a particular flow of the day? Is that still important as you would if you're working full time? Or is it more kind of, you know, as things are coming, let's just go by the flow?
So, I mean, I think you should take life easy, right? Why would you bind yourself to a certain routine, right? It's okay. You should have a reason to take a bath and go out of house. You should try to do every 2-3 days in a week. So for that, you have to put effort, but rest is okay.
Okay.
Or really when you want. Look at stock market when you want.
Makes sense. As a CFO, of course, you have looked at multiple different P&Ls over the years. You've worked across different industries. And now you're kind of also, you know, I would say you must have been investing in stocks over the period of time as well. If someone is looking to start investing in the stock market, from a CFO's perspective, what are the things that you think make sense for someone to look at and decipher what could be a good versus a not so good investment?
Okay, so I'll again divide this question into 2 parts. Someone who's already an investor, I would say a covered call strategy in options is a very, very good methodology to make money. Someone who's sitting with a good portfolio, he should definitely look at doing covered calls and doing some bit of options and future options. Someone who's new, the way I'll put it is that, you know, look at leaders in respective segments. I mean, today at where we are, I think the markets are quite expensive. We have factored all the positives. The markets have already factored everything which is positive, right? So anything which is negative can actually give, can be a little rude to the stock or to the market. So at this point of time, I would say list down 20-30 stocks which are leaders in respective segment. Keep a watch on those stocks. Whenever market always gives you opportunity to enter, you know, whenever those stocks crack, chip in. Whenever those stocks crash, chip in. So do small investments over a period of time, build a portfolio, and then look at taking larger bets. If the markets are down 15-20% from here, then you can look at deploying larger amounts, but not at this stage. And chipping in small quantities is always more safer and wise. That's how I put it.
Very cool. How would you think about the angel investments that you make? Is that also a kind of similar philosophy, or given the stage of the evolution of the companies, it changes a little bit? It's of course much more risk oriented investments.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the money which I allocate towards angel investing is the money which you have already written off. Right. So it should be money which you don't need. And obviously you're not throwing money, but in your head, you've already written it off. That's one. Number two, initially we used to look at investing at ideation stage, and most of the companies didn't do well. So we don't look at as a group and startups which are at ideation stage. So the criteria for us is that it needs to have proof of concept. It should be revenue making. You will invest basis in which sector it is. As a professional, you see scope in that sector. What is the USP? Does the founders have enough bandwidth? Are they passionate enough? Are they skilled enough to do that particular business? So confidence, their confidence, their knowledge will inspire you to invest with them. I think that's primarily what we look at. I mean, you come with we are a group of 150 plus members, almost from every industry. So they are able to gauge whether a particular business has a room for upside or not. And how can a new startup make a difference? How can they scale up? Will technology help? Are they looking at a certain niche which is untapped? And obviously, the founders, how well they are equipped, how much knowledge they have.
Makes sense. Sanjay, how do you define success?
You know, unfortunately, Rohit, in our country, we started poor in our country post-independence. Our father's generation and our generation, we have all worked with only one thing in mind, and that is how to make money. So success for us, unfortunately, is defined by how much wealth you have created, I think, which is not right. Obviously, this you realize with time that success does not mean money. To me, success means happiness. To me, success means peace. To me, success means living a good life. So obviously, at different stages of life, your criteria of success changes. Today, you know, I have a friend who has a startup in academics. They are working closely with the government of India, and they want to introduce the syllabus in such a way that the focus shifts from making money to making happiness. So today there are so many options in the country that one can work in the field where he has a passion. And if he is good, he'll end up making money also. So money should, to my kids, I would say, don't go for money. Go for something which you like and money will follow. Because you are already coming from a financial secured background. So you need to do something which gives you happiness. So the definition of success for me has changed. Success to me means happiness, peace. You need to sleep fully at night. That is happiness.
Very cool. Well, that brings us to our lightning round. It should be fun. All it takes is I'm going to ask you some very simple, quick questions, and I need immediate responses.
Okay.
All right.
Rapid fire.
Rapid fire, yes. Sweet or savory? What do you prefer?
Sweet.
Books or podcasts?
Books.
Thinker or doer?
Thinker.
Introvert or extrovert?
Introvert.
Tea or coffee?
I love coffee, but tea.
How does someone impress you?
See, when you meet someone, by your first look, 70% job is done. Right? And then the interaction makes the balance 30%. So a pleasant personality with a smile does a good job.
All right. I hope I left a good impression.
Thank you.
If you can be a CFO of any company for a day, which company would you choose and why?
Okay, so I'll have to give a thought that if I have to be a CFO of a company. I mean, I would try to look at an AI company just to get insight, because AI is going to hold a lot of future for us. You know, it is going to change, it's going to revolutionize a lot of things in the country. So I would like to look at how will it impact life of various companies and its own journey. I mean, it's a very, very different view.
Makes sense. If not a CFO, what would you be?
A businessman.
Okay. Any particular business area that you like?
I mean, I love manufacturing. Because something which is tangible, solid, which has less consumer dependence. It is less B2C. It is more B2B.
All right. Ideal place for you to retire. Do you plan to move out of Mumbai or Mumbai is...
No, Mumbai is going to be my base. We want to spend time in different places. We like hills, we like beaches, we like exploring the world. So the idea is from 90 days, how to go to 120 days or 140 days of travel. I am a nature lover. I've been thinking of taking a farm. But again, I'm not really sure because my wife says she can't live alone for long, long time. So Bombay will be our base. We'll keep shuttling.
What's the next travel destination on your list?
So we are doing Uzbekistan. It has a lot of history. Mughals came from there. A lot of architecture came from there. A little less on the tourist circuit. And that's what we intend to do.
Very cool. Did you have any role model during your professional period or, you know, maybe on your personal side?
I mean, two guys who were really impressed. One was a guy in Aaj Tak, Mr. Anil Mehra, great negotiator, highly principled, high value guy. I mean, I really look up to him. And second was Sameer Nair, my CEO at NTT Imagine. He used to always say, create hope and manage expectations. That's the mantra of surviving in a startup.
Wow, that's really deep. Very cool. One thing that could have made you 10 times more productive?
No, I think I'm quite productive.
All right. The last one. Describe yourself in 3 words.
Dependable, straight, and logical.
Very cool. Well, Sanjay, thank you so much for all your time here. This has been a super show. Really enjoyed doing it with you.
Thank you, Rohit. It is really a pleasure. I'm really happy. Thank you so much for having
Appreciate
me.
It.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. We hope you'll find at least one nugget that is beneficial to you. As always, thanks for listening to Strategy of Finance. If you enjoy the show, please rate and review us on YouTube, Apple Podcast, Spotify, or our website, www.strategyoffinance.com. Your comments will make us better. You can also follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter and share the word in your network so other people in the finance community can also benefit. Be sure to tune in next week for another engaging conversation. Until then, this is Rohit Agarwal, and remember to learn, grow, and inspire.